afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen. We're going to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Tuesday, May 18th, 2021. Good afternoon, Dave.
Hello, Melody.
Hello. And I think of Hello, Dolly. Well, hello, Dolly. Anyway, I'm not going to start singing on global radio, but hey.
Oh, go ahead. A star could be born.
Oh, yeah, no, I don't think so. Not at this late date. But a star was born again today. Gold was up another 320, a little, but 1870. Silver was up 5 cents at $28.30. We did have a high of 28.72, so it dropped quite a bit, but still up at 28.30. Platinum was down $19 at $1,226. Palladium was up $4, $2,966. The USDX today, she broke 90.46 to the downside. And gold's only up $3. Just wait till tomorrow. 89.76 for the U.S. dollar index. Crude oil was down 70 cents at 65.57. And let's go to the paper markets. The Dow closes down 260 points. And again, the mega cap tech stocks turned negative, 34,060. The S&P was down 35 at 4,127. And the NASDAQ was down 75, 13,303. And let's see. You know what cracks me up? Yellen is pushing for higher taxes. That's a negative on the economy and for the stock markets and everything in general. So go for it. Stronger unions. Oh, okay. More global competition. More global competition. Really? That means we have to get even lower wages to compete globally. But hey. Anyway, so we got a lot to talk about. Oh, let's go to the bond market and see what the 10-year yield did. That was up. It's still at 1.64, just kind of been hanging out at that level. And the European markets were a mixed bag. You have the DAX down. France was down. FTSE was higher. Asia, it was strong all across the board. So Asia had a good night anyway in their paper markets. So we're going to talk a little about a lot of things. We're going to talk about the housing starts. We're going to talk about oil. We're going to talk about manufacturing index. We're going to talk about a lot of these things. And the housing starts first. Let's get to the housing starts. It fell by more than what was forecasted. And that the supply chain disruptions and rising material costs are beginning to hold builders back. We talked a little bit about this yesterday, talked about how builders can't even lock in prices on homes they're building because of the increases in the lumber. And that's just talking about the lumber. You know, they lock in prices on homes and they end up losing $30,000, $40,000 in the lumber. And you talk about people, you know, if they're building homes, you don't start building a home until you're approved, usually, unless you have cash, by a mortgage company. And then all of a sudden you have to come up with a extra $30,000 or $40,000 that they're going to tag on to the end for the increased costs. I think a lot of deals are going to fall through, but because you really don't plan for those types of unforeseen situations. Residential starts decreased almost 10% in April. This was according to government data that was released today. They were expecting the median estimate economists called for was a 1.7 million pace. So, again, we've seen this construction held back by the supply chain constraints. And these just aren't little, you know, 20% increases. I mean, these increases are huge. So this strong demand for this residential real estate that was fueled by low borrowing costs. Everyone is hoping that it's going to bolster the markets, the housing markets in the coming months. There's backlogs continue to mount. We'll have to see if those backlogs actually get built. So anyway, it's an interesting situation, Dave.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you have this economist, Jennifer Lee at BMO Capital, who says too much demand, while a good thing, will eventually slow production and building. And that's happening right now and contributing to these housing price pressures. Now, while today's data were softer than expected, there are still signs that the housing market is strong, as housing starts and permits do remain elevated when compared to pre-pandemic days. But it's a far cry from, say, last spring when housing starts fell into the mid-900,000s, although last month's figure is below where we were right before the pandemic started in the U.S. Regardless, earlier this week, a measure of home builder sentiment held steady and does continue to top its pre-pandemic level. So that's about it. I mean, we see that overall construction declined in the Midwest and South while rising in the Northeast and West.
Well, you know, we talk a lot about oil prices, and prices for diesel are up 40%, 39.6. So far this year, crude oil is up 36%. And gasoline is up 53%. You know, I mean, these are huge. And all of them, not surprisingly, have delivered some strong returns with the paper markets for these major oil companies like Exxon, Chevron, Occidental. We certainly see that the energy index has been the far best performing of the index 11 sectors, delivering huge gains, 43%. So, you know, this is rising oil prices have become a major concern for businesses and a common pain point listed by consumers, but especially after the Colonial Pipeline hack.
Yeah,
where do
we
go from here, Dave?
Up, up, and away. Yes. It looks like, I mean, nationally, gas prices are averaged $3.05 a gallon last week. That's the highest since October of 2014. Almost 12,000 gas stations were without fuel as of Monday. That's according to Reuters. Now, most of them are in the South. U.S. crude exports fell to around 1.8 million barrels a day last week. That's the lowest since October of 2018. While crude inventories fell 400,000 barrels versus an expected 2.8 million barrel draw. So that's a huge difference. Number of total oil products supply saw the biggest weekly decline and lowest weekly demand last week since January. On the other side, Melody, the industry expectations continue to grow that demand will pick up further adding to this supply-demand mismatch, raising prices further. Yesterday, OPEC stuck to a forecast for a strong recovery in world demand this year, with growth in China and U.S. outweighing the impact of the pandemic in India. So we'll see. I mean, you got Goldman Sachs saying prices will hit $80 this summer. Commodities will rally another 13%+ over the next 6 months. Oh, no, sounds like a good scenario. For gold and silver, Melody, what do you think?
Well, sure. I mean, little by little, we're going to continue to see these prices rise. And, they're going to run it. I mean, they run these markets. A lot of it is done by paper trading, but they're still going to run it. And No, you know, great economies. I mean, yeah, you know, when things are booming, you know, the housing market is booming. That's a good thing if everything else is working properly, but it isn't. And so, you know, everybody's getting a little ahead of themselves. And, you know, enjoy it again while we can. That's the best thing that we can do. Enjoy it while we have it. And start saving those pennies, because I do believe things will become more and more expensive. And I don't think the Fed can control it, they tell us it's at 2%, but it certainly isn't. And eventually it goes high enough where they have to respond. I mean, you know, they're going to have to respond and treat inflation. And they can't treat it by still saying it's at 2%. So yesterday, the New York State Manufacturing Index fell from its April level, and it missed economists' expectations. But the prices component jumped to the highest level on record this month. It's the latest in a growing line of local business surveys that show prices rising to years long or record highs. The Empire State report also is seen as a leading indicator of a national trend. The record high price reading caused little to no reaction in the Treasury market. Dave, I would think that would be because the Fed's in there playing with it.
I think so.
You think they are?
Teeter-tottering.
I wonder what really keeps them up at night, if anything. But this suggests that traders have already factored in significant inflation. I don't think they have. I think they're buying this story that it's short-term. I think they're buying this story that it's supply and demand that's pushing the price up and are not reacting or reflecting that it isn't, but it's our monetary policy. It's our dollar weakening. But, hey, that'll come soon enough. But we're going to be talking a little bit more about inflation in the context of the gold standard and how the Fed has failed at its mandate in today's last segment. You're going to take that over, Dave, so it'll be a great segment.
Yes, I expect there'll be some real good information in there for listeners, Melody. Now, let's go halfway around the world to Japan, the third largest economy in the world. Their economy shrank by over 5% in the first quarter, putting its economy again at risk of falling back into recession. And with Japan's economy shrinking by more than expected in the first quarter and at risk for another contraction this quarter, certainly the global rebound or recovery theme, whatever you want to call it, looks to be at risk. If ever it wasn't in the last year. Now, already the EU has said its economy shrank by almost 2% year over year in the first quarter, and that's on top of almost 0.5% in the fourth quarter last year. And India is facing tremendous growth challenges as a result of the spreading pandemic there. So three of the world's five largest economies are facing significant challenges at the start of what was supposed to be a breakout year for global economic recovery after 2020's state of malaise. I don't know, Melody. The uncertainty seems to be greater than ever.
Mm. Well, you know, yesterday we had good stories, an hour
you did.
Of good stories. We did.
Oh, I'm sorry I missed it.
We did. And although I think there's a little catch, I always have a little catch in these stories, but Bank of America says that it's going to boost its minimum hourly wage to $25. Now, it's not going to happen until 2025, though. So Lord knows. I mean, that $25 in 2025 will probably be buying less than what it is than the $20 an hour today, would be my prediction.
Good point.
For 2025. So, you know, again, image building to make it an announcement, 4 years. I mean, who can plan on 4 years? But they do have a, currently it is $20, their minimum wage. They've had 4 years of pay increases that brought their minimum wage to $20 in 2020 from $15. And think about that, $20 today. If you go back 5 years, does that same $20 buy what it did 5 years ago? No. The Charlotte, North Carolina-based lender is also going to require its U.S. vendors to pay employees dedicated to the bank $15 per hour or more. You know, kudos to them. Again, I'm not saying it sounds great news and everything, but again, banks shouldn't require other people to do things that they're doing. And then, Dave, how often do we talk about technology and robots, and how many branches have closed from the last 5 years due to, you know, the tellers, they're gone. All thousands. The ATM machines, thousands and thousands.
Thousands.
So you lay off thousands and thousands, so those who are working. So it doesn't affect the bank in any manner. They're just readjusting, repositioning. And I would expect by 2025, there will be even more robotics in the service sector.
Oh, yeah. We read all the time, don't we, about how the larger companies in particular are ramping up their robotic replacements of humans. Yeah. And the pandemic apparently has only accelerated that move. So, yeah, there's one of the oldest buildings in my small hometown. Actually, there are three of them. Two of them were long ago converted to apartments. One is a condo. The third, most recent, though, has been sitting idle for, I think, now going on 3 years, right in the middle of our main street, former bank. I guess if there's any good news, there's reports of a local family having bought it or leased it and they're going to convert it into a coffee shop. So what do you think?
$20 a cup. Well, I think that's great. You know, I think that's great. Anybody that's, you know, tries it, I hope they're very, very successful.
Yeah, but I would reportedly think a non-franchise. So hopefully,
yes.
Hopefully it'll only be $10 a cup.
Yes. Support those folks, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back. Please
stay tuned.
You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseVoicesOfIntegrity.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody the rest of today's program as she sneaks off. Nah, we won't say sneak, as she slips off to man the office, the phones, and to take care of customer orders. You can always call her at 1-800-375-4188. Just be sure to wish her a great day. She deserves it. She works hard to bring you news like this 5 days a week. What other gold and silver dealers do you know that does that anywhere? If they're out there, they're not very many of them. Discount Gold and Silver Trading. You can always depend on it and Melody Cederstrom. Now, where to go here? Just a couple of news quicks. A year ago, experts predicted that one-third of the restaurants in America might close in 2020 as a result of the pandemic. Chef and activist Tom Colicchio said the number could go as high as 75%. Well, new data from the National Restaurant Association, Washington's other NRA, found that 90,000 restaurants across the country have closed permanently or long-term. That's a lot. Although on a percentage basis, and this therein lies the consolation, that's less than 14% of the country's restaurants and lower than the 110,000 figure reported by the association in December when it described the industry in an economic free fall. Well, that's still almost twice the 50,000 restaurants that shutter in a typical year. The most dire scenarios were averted, the industry says, thanks to initiatives like the government's payback protection program, as well as loosening in local restrictions. And as Melody alluded to at the top of the program, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen headed into the belly of the beast today, asking the business community to support the president's $2.3 trillion infrastructure plan, that during a speech to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Now, by trying to persuade a skeptical and targeted audience in this case, Yellen, they say, is signaling the president's commitment to raising corporate taxes to pay for his plan. Republican senators, critical to a potential bipartisan deal, oppose any corporate tax increase. Yellen told the chamber, "We are confident that the investments and tax proposals in the American Job Plan, taken as a whole, will enhance the net profitability of our corporations and improve their global competitiveness." There's that word again. "We hope that business leaders will see it this way and support the jobs plan." Now, administration is working to build support in and out of Washington as it waits the second counterproposal from Senate Republicans, who are, again, critical to any bipartisan deal. Their initial offer of about $570 billion, they say, could climb as high as $800 billion, but they have declared the 2017 corporate and individual tax cuts as off limits. Now, if you happen to catch our blog on Friday, we gave an update on the status of LIBOR. That's the benchmark interest rate that's tied to trillions of dollars of financial contracts around the world. Well, indeed, the clock is ticking on a replacement for LIBOR, the widely used and discredited benchmark interest rate. but the transition to a successor has been anything but smooth and timely. As we discussed a few years ago, several times on this program, the London Interbank Offered Rate, that's LIBOR, fell out of favor during the Great Recession after regulators found widespread manipulation of the rate by traders at numerous too-big-to-fail banks. Global regulators initially set a deadline of the end of 2021 for doing away with LIBOR after several big banks were fined billions of dollars for trying to rig the rate. And surprise, surprise, they got off easy. LIBOR is used to price global financial contracts worth around $400 trillion, half of which are in U.S. dollar contracts, making it a huge task for the market to switch to an alternative. So far, investors and others who pay attention to these kinds of things aren't raising too many concerns over the uncertainty and delay. But the process of transitioning to a new benchmark, widely thought to be the Secured Overnight Financing Rate, or SOFR, has dragged on, and talk of using more alternatives is spreading. The ICE, ICE Benchmark Administration, takes quotes from a panel of banks to compile different LIBOR rates across a range of currencies. IBA has said it would stop publishing the one-week and two-month U.S. dollar LIBOR by the end of 2021. All remaining LIBOR rates, which are more heavily used, will cease now on June 30th, 2023. Now, I read where IBA says it's extending the use of some dollar LIBOR rates to that time because it wants most existing contracts to mature before their LIBOR experiences disruptions. But U.S. regulators say the new 2023 deadline only applies to existing LIBOR contracts and warns markets to stop using it, LIBOR, as soon as practicable, in their words. No new LIBOR contracts will be allowed after January 1st, 2022. They add that, now that's in U.S. dollars. They added that using U.S. dollar LIBOR after 2021 would create safety and soundness risks and will examine bank practices accordingly, just like you did after the Great Recession. Interestingly, an 18-month extension was not proposed by IBA for the rate's other denominations, the euro, pound sterling, Swiss franc, and Japanese yen. Now, that's reportedly at least in part a reflection of the heavier usage of the U.S. dollar version in financial contracts, you know, from auto loans to credit cards and mortgages to BUCO corporate loans. Uses of LIBOR in other currencies have often been told by the regulators to shift the price of existing contracts to alternative rates that are set by central banks before the end of 2021 or risk ending up in the woeful legal vacuum. And then there's the Alternative Reference Rates Committee, the so-called ARRC. We'll call it ARC for short. It's an industry group convened by the Federal Reserve, which has said that the extension of some LIBOR contracts would help accelerate the transition from LIBOR to SOFR. Tom Wythe, who chairs the ARC and, yes, is a vice chair, too big to fail, Morgan Stanley, said the extension should give people the clarity they need to navigate this transition with more information than they had before today. If you say so, Tommy. Now, while the pandemic has slowed the transition to SOFR, the new benchmark apparently has found some traction. For example, the CME Group, notorious now, most recently in some people's minds, more on that in a future program, reported that in October, the average daily trading volume of SOFR futures increased by 28% from a year prior. So I guess they're measured by that, there is some traction. Then there are too big to fail Bank of America and JP Morgan Chase, both of which have used a new Bloomberg index, in fact, at a sizable trade earlier this month. And that sets up a potential competition with SOFR. Analysts say that the BOA JPM move could signify diverging big investor opinion on the matter, as more people think multiple benchmarks will replace LIBOR instead of just SOFR. The mega Wall Street investment banks and asset managers will no doubt find their way through this new maze with their bloated staffs and self-dealing practices, but smaller regional banks and funds that, as a rule, serve smaller businesses and rural communities may not have the same depth to adapt as quickly, thus making an already uneven playing field all that more lopsided. Now that we know the mega banks and the Fed have their fingerprints all over this coming transition, ladies and gentlemen, at least in the U.S., I'm sure feeling confident about whatever comes next. Does the same apply to you? Now, turn to foreign policy for a minute. In her column today, New York Times opinion writer Michelle Goldberg pointed to a Jared Kushner quote from 2 months ago when he said, "We are witnessing the last vestiges of what has been known as the Arab-Israeli conflict." Kushner was surveying the results of the Abraham Accords, the now discredited, some say fake, Middle East peace plan he helped negotiate. Goldberg writes, I'm quoting here, "At the heart of his supreme self-assurance and of the accords themselves was the deadly fiction that the Palestinians were so abject and defeated that Israel could simply ignore their demands." Kushner claims, she says, the Abraham Accords exposed the conflicts as nothing more than a real estate dispute between Israelis and Palestinians that need not hold up Israel's relation with the broader Arab world. Now, to circumvent that dispute, the U.S. set about, in her words, bribing other Arab and Muslim countries to normalize relations with Israel. The UAE, the United Arab Emirates, for example, got an enormous arms deal. Morocco got the U.S. to support its annexation of the Western Sahara. And Sudan inexplicably got taken off America's list of state sponsors of terrorism. But the explosion of fighting in Israel and Palestine in recent days makes clear something that never should have been in doubt. Justice for the Palestinians is a precondition for peace. And one reason there's been so little for the Palestinians, so little justice, that is because of the foreign policy of Israel's big brother and biggest ally, the United States. Jeremy Ben-Ami, who's president of the Zionist group J Street, said, "I don't think that there's any way this occupation and creeping annexation process could have gotten where it is today if the United States had said no." Goldberg believes one can condemn Hamas and its rockets and still recognize that the current conflict began with Israeli overreach, born of a sense of impunity. Again, her words. She points to a major flashpoint, the campaign led by Israeli settlers to evict Palestinian families from their homes in the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. Thus, she argues, the Palestinians fear that Israel is trying to push them out of Jerusalem altogether. And that, in turn, has let Hamas position itself as Jerusalem's protector. Interesting perspective. And now Israel seems to consider its right to defend itself from Hamas justification for causing an obscene number and growing number of civilian casualties, most of them women and young children. Tariq Bakoni of the International Crisis Group argues that in some ways, the Trump administration was simply more honest than its predecessors about its disregard for the Palestinians. All the same, he added, Trump's foreign policy allowed the Israeli right wing to understand that they can get away with the most extreme policies. And they continue. Before Trump, it was common to say that the occupation would eventually force Israel to choose between being a Jewish state and a democratic one. Well, during the Trump years, Israel's choice under Netanyahu in particular, became undeniable. Bocconi believes the death of a two-state framework has strengthened a sense of common destiny between Palestinians in the occupied territories and Arab Israelis, or as many refer to themselves, Palestinian citizens of Israel. Goldberg concludes today's column by arguing it's not enough for Joe Biden to be a little better than Trump or his predecessors, or to try to restart a spectral peace process. If Israel can no longer afford to ignore the demands of the Palestinians, then neither can we. Let me know how you feel about this opinion. Email me at daveallen.usa@yahoo.com. That's daveallen.usa@yahoo.com. We'll read your response on Thursday's program. Now, staying overseas of sorts, the Senate, or with foreign policy anyway, the U.S. Senate has voted to move ahead with a bill that would jumpstart U.S. R&D with a cash infusion of more than $100 billion as part of a broad push to strengthen American technological competitiveness against a rising China. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer called the legislation a once-in-a-generation investment in American science and technology. He added that holding the Chinese Communist Party accountable for its years of rapacious economic policies and theft of American ingenuity will help create a level playing field that American workers have lacked for decades. The bill Schumer introduced with Indiana Republican Senator Todd Young is known as the Endless Frontier Act, and it's now headed for as much as 2 weeks of debate on the Senate floor. It'll also be combined with China-related legislation advanced by a number of other Senate committees, including foreign relations and banking. Schumer said he expects this bill will pass by the end of the month. The bill's path in the House, however, is less certain. It's consensus that it's highly unlikely the Senate version will simply be agreed to there. And that will take us into our second break. Glad you're sticking with us. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cedarstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cedarstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSC Talk Radio. CommonSenseVoicesOfIntegrity.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm not Melody Cedarstrom. She's taking care of client business in the office, but I am Dave Allen. I'll be here with you for the next 15 minutes. Let's take a deep dive right into it. For much of its 108-year history, the Federal Reserve had either an implied or explicit mandate to preserve the value of the U.S. dollar, and it has failed spectacularly. Between the Fed's founding in 1913 and 2012, the dollar lost about 96% of its buying power. In 2012, the Fed formally dropped the value preservation pretense, brazenly declaring henceforth it will deliberately cultivate price inflation at, you've heard it from Melody earlier in the program, 2% a year. Well, in the context of a single year, 2% may not sound like much. However, just like small plumbing leaks quietly causing devastation over time, a steady loss of a modest amount of purchasing power each year accumulates to a major blow to the dollar and our pocketbooks. Now, naturally, the Fed didn't say it wants to cut the value of the dollar by 26% in 15 years, but that's how the math plays out. When announcing its new philosophy, the Fed claimed a 2% inflation rate is most consistent over the long run with the Fed's statutory mandate. Is it? I mean, the Federal Reserve Reform Act of 1977 directs the Fed to promote the goals of maximum employment, stable prices, and moderate long-term interest rates. The Fed is clearly applying a broad interpretation of the word stable. Would a doctor use that term to describe a patient's pulse that keeps losing 2 beats per minute at hourly intervals? Well, it wasn't long until the Fed was straining at the longer monetary leash it had given itself. And then last year, it declared that rather than viewing 2% as an upper limit on annual price increases, it would feel free to let inflation run hotter in any given year, pursuant to hitting a 2% average over time. And given history's many examples of runaway inflation, that sounds a lot like the Fed's playing with fire, doesn't it? An August 2020 clarification on the Fed's philosophy offered little reassurance when Fed Chair Jerome Powell said this: We are not tying ourselves to a particular mathematical formula that defines the average. Thus, our approach could be viewed as a flexible form of average inflation targeting. Put your hands around that one. An average without a particular mathematical formula. That sounds all too flexible indeed. This spring, Fed officials have been assuring Americans time and time again that recent price increases are merely transitory, that they don't mark the start of a long-term upward trend. The title of our article in Monday's newsletter, American Survival. Its title is, If You Think Inflation is Transitory, Think Again. In the wake of April's inflation data out last week, those assurances from the Fed are looking increasingly empty. First came the market-jarring report that consumer prices were 4.2% higher than last year. Then we learned the producer price index jumped 6.2% year over year. That's the largest jump since that index started in 2010. Remember that 2% inflation target? Consumer prices have already risen 2% in the first 4 months of 2021 alone, with month-to-month increases growing steadily larger. To boot, so far this year, the Consumer Price Index has risen 0.2% in January, 0.4% in February, 0.6% in March, and 0.8% in April. And that's just how the government measures it. Shadowstat.com's John Williams says, using methodologies that were in place, that were used by the government in 1980, inflation is actually around 12%, not 4.2%. Now, our article in this week's American Survival Newsletter shows the history of inflation in the context of the gold standard, before, during, and after. That study conducted in 2009 at the height of the Great Recession found that during the period of 1914, when the CPI was first published, to 1932, the year before FDR made it illegal for American citizens to trade gold for dollars, price inflation averaged just 1.43%, again, as measured by the government. During the period of 1933 to 1970, it's the year before Nixon ended the gold standard altogether, inflation averaged 2.97%, more than double the prior period. And in the period of 1971 to 2008, the year before this study was conducted, when the U.S. economy was truly fiat currency-based, inflation averaged 4.47%, virtually triple the average under the gold standard. Regardless of whether price inflation is 4.2%, as the government now measures it, or 12%, as suggested by shadowstats.com, it's critical to remember that consumer price increases are driven in large part by the Fed's creation of new money. Thus, there's ample reason to think inflationary pressures will continue to grow thanks to the Fed's unspoken mandate, which is aiding and abetting federal government deficit spending and propping up the paper markets. As we reported last week, for the first 7 months of fiscal year 2021, the federal government's fiscal year, the government spent 90% more money than it took in. That is, since October 1st, we've spent $4.1 trillion versus receiving $2.1 trillion in revenue. When the government spends more money than it takes in, we know it covers the difference by issuing debt in the form of treasury bonds. To create artificial demand for that debt and force interest rates lower than what a rational market would demand, especially from an entity that's $28 trillion in debt, the Fed's been buying much of the new debt with money it creates out of thin air. This eyebrow-raising practice is called monetizing the debt. And in recent years, the Fed's been taking it to extreme levels. For example, in March and April last year alone, the Fed monetized over $1.5 trillion of federal debt, everything the Treasury borrowed during that span, in 2 months. Now, you may not know, the Fed's barred from buying debt directly from the government. In what is essentially a sham, the Fed simply waits until the debt's issued to the public and then buys it from a select group of too-big-to-fail banks and other mega Wall Street money firms who are in the scam. It bears repeating again that the Fed does this by creating new money, with the consequence of reducing the value of other money already in circulation. As a means of financing government, then, inflation is essentially a tax that everyone pays, but nobody votes for, unless you count the unelected appointees to the Federal Reserve. Well, whose appointments, I guess, are nominated by a duly elected president and confirmed by duly elected senators. So I guess, ladies and gentlemen, everything's all kosher in the end. Don't you agree? Well, then, if you agree or if you don't, keep on listening. And while we won't have time for it today, if you tune in tomorrow or Wednesday, give us a call. We can talk about it on the air. Todd, I forget that number. Can you tell us what that is, please? What's the call-in number to our program? Thank you very much. All right, ladies and gentlemen, in the remaining time of today's program, let's talk about Ponzi schemes. Oh!
The number is 844-769-2944.
Thank you, Todd, our engineer and producer. Don't hesitate to call us if you want to comment on that story or on Michelle Goldberg's opinion about the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. Now let's turn our attention to Ponzi schemes, the biggest one, cryptocurrencies. Late last month, Bloomberg's Joe Wiesenthal, who has a podcast I listen to occasionally for some interesting tidbits, he wrote a piece about where the crypto world is headed. He said, "We're living in the golden age of Ponzi's, pump and dumps, and pyramid schemes." Boy, sounds like a lot of fun. "There are a few things that make this moment in crypto la-la land unique. The key is the rise of these so-called decentralized exchanges, where literally anyone can create a token like Jokecoin, literally, and have it listed. In the past, for a token to list on a legit exchange, it had to demonstrate that it was a serious project. Or it had to pay a large fee to an exchange like Binance in exchange for its listing. No more. With decentralized exchanges where trading happens right on a blockchain itself, there are no gatekeepers." And that's what a lot of proponents are touting about cryptocurrencies. It's why opponents believe it's the most dangerous thing going. In any event, in many cases, it doesn't take much in the way of development jobs to create a coin. You just copy and paste from, you know, the code from somewhere and change a few things like its name. Throw into the mix TikTok and other social media platforms where influencers can pump the coin, and you have a recipe for transparent games. Transparent, but dangerously speculative. Everyone knows it's a joke, most everyone, but no one cares, really, because as long as they get into the joke early enough and sell before the peak, they're happy. That's the game. Anyway, Dave Portnoy did a thing on Twitter yesterday where he announced his support for a coin named SafeMoon. And then he said the magic words, "If it's a Ponzi, get in on the ground floor." Are you kidding me? Even Wiesenthal said in late April, the thing about these coins right now is you can get in early on the next Bernie Madoff. Wiesenthal thought that was maybe a little harsh, but Portnoy just went and said it too. He actually said that. And that is what the crypto world, ladies and gentlemen, is all about. Yes, you might make some money if you are one of the chosen ones, but there are few. Enter it at your own risk. All right, in the last couple of minutes, let's go here. This bugs me. I'm a big proponent of reining in uncompetitive monopolies, and there's so many of them in our lives today. you may disagree with me, and if you do, that's fine. I respect your opinion. Some believe in a laissez-faire, totally free market, unregulated economy where things are as they are. But I think the proposed mega merger of Discovery and AT&T Media is likely to trigger a chain reaction of other media giants looking to form even bigger monopolistic combinations. Now, there was a time, in a galaxy long, long ago, mind you, when most Americans got their news and entertainment from three broadcast networks and maybe a handful of Hollywood studios in their local paper. Today, Americans get content from hundreds of different sources, but they're increasingly being gobbled up by the same owners. In the hours after the announcement of the new media behemoth that includes a combination of Warner Media and Discovery, insiders already speculated which would be the next big deal. Will it be Comcast? That's a good guess. Comcast merging with Viacom, CBS. That's what some are already saying. It shouldn't be allowed to happen, at least not without public input, because all they're going to do is lay off thousands of employees, raise your monthly rates, and go on to hog heaven. Well, that's the end of today's program, ladies and gentlemen. I enjoyed hanging with you. Melody will be back tomorrow with Butch and Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Have a great night, and please, please be safe out there. Bye-bye. If I got me a wealthy man.